Good morning. I would invite you to be turning in your Bibles to Genesis chapter 15. That's where we're going to begin in just a moment as we think a little bit about marriage and continuing, as we said yesterday, continuing today with the principles that are associated with marriage, and one in particular that we'll look at this morning that will hopefully help us not only in our own marriages, but especially as we are raising children and as we're helping them get closer to that particular phase in their life. We're going to talk about the concept of a marriage covenant, or what it means to have a covenant marriage. And I think that's very important, because our culture, the concept of covenant is not really even a well-known thing. Outside of a biblical understanding, we don't really even think about or use that word very often in regards to covenant. But it's a very strong term biblically, and I think God would have us to understand that. So I want you to read with me, if you would, in Genesis chapter 15. God has made promises to Abram. Back in chapter 12, he started and made some promises to Abram about a land he was going to have, about a great nation that he was going to become, and about all the nations of the earth were going to be blessed through his seed. So you have that threefold promise that is being made to Abram. And it's interesting, because Abram's going to kind of ask him, how do I know? How do I know this is going to happen? I want you to pick up with me in verse 7 of chapter 15. And he said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out from Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess. But he said, O Lord God, how am I to know I shall possess it? I don't know if you ever even thought about that question. God's speaking to you directly, and God says, here's what I'm going to do. And you say, how do I know that's really going to happen, God? Well, you have to understand, Abram doesn't have this long time contact. The writings of the Old Testament are non-existent at this point. And so this is a relatively new relationship from that standpoint. But he said to me, bring me a heifer 3 years old, a female goat 3 years old, a ram 3 years old, a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. And he brought all of these to him and cut them in half and laid each half over against the other, but he did not cut the birds in half. And when the birds of prey came down on the carcasses, Abram drove them away. And the sun was going down, and a deep sleep fell on Abram, and behold, a dreadful and great darkness fell upon him. And the Lord said to Abram, know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. But I'll bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace, and you shall be buried at a good old age. And they shall come back here in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. And when the sun had gone down and it was dark, behold, a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch passed between those pieces. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your offspring I will give this land. And then he's going to describe the parameters of that land. And so he wants to help Abram understand that they are entering into a covenant agreement. And so I want us to think in terms of, what would it mean if we understood that our marriage was a covenant? Because that's the way God described it in Malachi, when he said the wife, or the covenant wife, he said, of your youth, when he was faulting the Israelites for being so unfaithful in their lives in general and in their marriages as well. He said, the covenant wife of your youth. And so think about what happened here, and how similar what happened is with Abram and God is to the concept of marriage. Abram had a name change. He's Abram at this point, but after he makes his covenant with God, and by the time you get to Genesis chapter 17, where you're going to have a circumcision, as far as Abraham's part in committing to the covenant of God, he's going to go from Abram to Abraham, very similar to the way we have a name change when we enter into the covenant of marriage. He was going to have to leave his home in order to come to a new home. God says, I've called you out of your home, Ur of the Chaldees, going to come to a new home. very similarly to the way we do when we get married. Normally, but not always, but normally, the wife leaves her home and comes to the home of the husband. There was an exchange. Whenever I do a wedding ceremony, I ask, are there rings to exchange? And those rings are exchanged for what purpose? They are tokens. They are to show the commitment that we have made. And so God is going to give Abram a land. Two chapters later, Abram is going to give a gift a little more painful. He's going to give the gift of his foreskin when he is circumcised in order to enter into the covenant with God. But there is an exchange. In other words, both of them said, here's what I am giving in order to demonstrate that I'm entering into this covenant. The children of this covenant got the inheritance. Abram's children and grandchildren and all his descendants got the land that was promised. It wouldn't come for about 400 years or so, but they're going to get the land that is promised. And then all the children of Abram, those who are faithful to God, when you get to the New Testament, but through the seed of Jesus Christ, we're told in Galatians, that one seed, Jesus Christ, all nations are blessed. And so we all receive the inheritance as a part of that. The problem is we're in a culture that sees marriage too much like a contractual agreement. And I think it's important for us to especially help our children to understand the covenant nature of a marriage ceremony. So I'm going to look at 4 points this morning that I think are like a covenant when we think about our marriage ceremony and how it is that we understand our covenant before God. Deuteronomy chapter 23. You may want to turn there. There are some promises made, and there's some statements made about the nature of even making a promise. I don't know how familiar you are with different celebrities, that kind of thing, but Adam Levine, I don't know if that name rings a bell with anybody or not. Adam Levine, a singer, part of Maroon 5, a relatively recent group. They crashed several weddings and played at those weddings without letting the people know, with the exception of one person involved in the wedding, knew that it was going to happen. So can you imagine if at your wedding, if you were a big Maroon 5 fan, or if you were a big Adam Levine fan, or I want you to think about anybody, the most popular person you could think of, and you were able to tell people, you're not going to believe who was at my wedding. Adam Levine and Maroon 5 were at my wedding. Oprah Winfrey did that same thing several years ago with her friend. They took presents, and so I'm sure everybody was glad to see them because they brought presents to the wedding. But being able to tell that, here's who was there. I appreciated there was a, when President Eisenhower was serving as president of this country, he would normally worship at the same place. I don't even know which group it was, but he'd worship at the same place in Washington, D.C., and it was known that he would worship there anytime he was in town on a Sunday. Somebody called that church on one occasion and asked the preacher, said, is President Eisenhower going to be there Sunday? And I love the preacher's response. He says, we don't know. They never tell us when the president is going to be here. He says, but you may want to come because we're relatively sure that God will be here. I love that response. Really, who is the most important person that was at your wedding if you're already married? I mean, your spouse was certainly important. But whenever I do a wedding ceremony, it is always me saying something like, we are here in the presence of God. That's the nature of a wedding. We're in the presence of God. And look at Deuteronomy chapter 23, because God talks about that. And if you were in a shotgun wedding, you didn't have any choice, then Deuteronomy 23 really doesn't apply to you. But if you weren't in a shotgun wedding and nobody was forcing you to marry your spouse, then it would apply. In Deuteronomy chapter 23, starting in verse 21, if you make a vow to the Lord your God, you shall not delay fulfilling it, for the Lord your God will surely require it of you, and you will be guilty of sin. But if you refrain from vowing, you will not be guilty of sin. You shall be careful to do what has passed from your lips, for you have voluntarily vowed to the Lord your God what you have promised with your mouth. That's a powerful statement. He says, God says, I just need you to understand something. If you have, in fact, made a vow, in other words, our wedding vows, we call them, the promises that we made at our wedding, God says, I fully expect you to understand how important that is. And he says, because nobody made you say that. Somebody asked you. In our case, the preacher would say, Mark, do you or will you? And he would follow that with some line. And now I have a choice at that point. God says, you're going to voluntarily make a statement. I had a choice of saying, you know what, I've rethought this. I can't make that commitment. But I didn't. I made that commitment. I said, I will. I do. God just says, if that's what you did, understand how critical that is. And so it's important for our children as they're growing up, especially, to understand you're entering into a covenant. And here's the difference between a covenant and a contractual agreement. We're in a society that contracts are the common thing. It didn't used to be that way. I'm guessing there's people in this congregation that are old enough to remember when many times you could just extend a hand and shake hands with somebody on a deal that you had made, and both of you understood that the other person would do what they're supposed to do. Give me a nod of a head if you ever remember those times. How safe would you feel doing that in most places now? How about a car dealer? No, look, I promise, that brand new car, I'll pay you for it. Let's just shake on it. He's going to make you sign a bunch of paperwork to prove that you're going to pay it, and you get a house. You're going to have to sign a bunch of paperwork, but you know what the most important paper you sign if you're signing and buying a house? Out of all those papers, deeds and mortgages, all that kind of thing, one transcends all the rest for a Christian. There's a piece of paper that's called a promissory note. And that is you making a vow before your God and whoever you're purchasing something from that says, I promise to pay this back. That in and of itself, without any other paperwork, should obligate a Christian to do what he said. Because God says, if I say I'll do it, then I should do it. So he says, first off, marriage ceremonies are conducted before God, and we need to understand how critically important that is. Secondly, they are both conducted before witnesses. Matthew 18 is not about weddings, and it's not even about covenants, but it is about witnesses. When Jesus was talking and saying, you know what, if you got a problem with a brother, says you need to go to that brother. You know, this is a whole separate side sermon, is it not? You have a problem with somebody, go talk to the person you have the problem with. Don't talk to everybody else about the problem. Talk to the person you have the problem with. And that was Jesus' advice. Jesus said, go to the person. And he said, but if you can't settle it, you know, I've got a big issue with Cole. I don't really. I'm saying if I had, maybe I should have started that phrase with if. If I had a big issue with Cole. He says, Mark, you go to Cole. Don't talk to everybody else about it. Go to Cole. And if you and Cole can solve it, he says, that's great. Because not only is the problem solved, nobody else has to even know it existed. It doesn't have to come into play for anybody. You got it solved. That's perfect. That's Christianity in its purest and finest form. He says, but if you can't get it resolved, take witnesses, two or three witnesses. He says, because the purpose of that is to establish the truthfulness. I do a lot of marriage counseling, if you will, with couples individually, and remarkable how often I will be talking to a couple, and he says, here's what she did, or here's what she said. And he said, she says, no, that's not what I said. Here's what I said. Here's what I did. Here's what he said. Here's what he did. I stop him after the first he said, she said. I said, let me tell you where I stand on this. I don't care. They're a little shocked at that, but I'm saying, I don't care because I can't solve that. I wasn't there. So how am I going to know who's telling the absolute truth? If there were two other people that were there and saying, no, he doesn't think he said that, but that is what he said. We were there and we witnessed it. We would understand. There's a different level of truthfulness to that. God says there are witnesses at your wedding. How many people, give me a nod of a head or raise my hand or anything, how many of you in here had a register type book when people came in that they signed as they went into your wedding? Yeah, that happens pretty frequently. You know what's interesting? When that started, people didn't sign that when they went in. We sign it now to say we're here, and so that they can know who came to the wedding, so they can send thank you cards, so they can give thank yous for the gifts, whatever the case may be. It used to be a witness register. You signed it as you went out. And what you were telling the couple was, I heard what you said, and you were signing that. And I'm going to be one of the ones that helps hold you accountable to that. There was a time in Russia where the best man had to sign a contract that if the wedding didn't last at least 6 months, that the best man had to pay a fine. So that'd make you rethink, wouldn't it? Somebody says, hey, you be my best man? I don't know. Let's talk about how serious you are about this. I'm not paying a fine for you. As I mentioned, Judy and I got married back in 77. Previous century, 77. And so we've been married a long time. There's a teacher that I had when I was at Florida College that was small but very intimidating. Incredible Bible scholar, and he was a Gold Gloves boxer in his youth. Judy grew up with his family. They knew each other intimately. None of them knew me very well, and I was a new Christian. At our reception, he came up and tapped me on the shoulder, and I turned around, and he goes, did you hear what you said? And I'm telling you, I was scared, because I came up with a background where my language was not right. I mean, I would say things I shouldn't say. I thought, surely I wasn't cursing at my own reception. And I played all my conversations through my mind, and I thought, no, I think I'm good there. And so I said, I'm sorry, Brother Curry. It was Melvin Curry. And I said, sorry, Brother Curry. And he said, I'm asking you, did you hear what you said? And I thought, oh, what in the world? Was I gossiping about somebody? What was going on? I didn't understand. And so I finally said a third time, I said, Brother Curry, I don't understand. He says, when you were up front and the preacher asked you to make those promises, did you hear what you said? Because I did, and I will hold you to it. I thought, wow, that's 48 years ago. And I tell that story, and I turn around because I think, I hope he's not behind me. It made a huge impression. It made a huge impression. He was just saying, I'm not here just to enjoy a celebration. I want you to think about that next time you attend somebody's wedding. You serve a much bigger purpose than just going to celebrate and enjoy with them. You serve a purpose of witnessing the vows that they're taking, and you should help them to hold true to those vows that they're taking. You think about people watching, and covenants were normally watched by people. Think about that, your wedding. Think about if you had to cut a couple cows in half, a couple sheep in half, a couple goats in half, you're cutting these animals in half, and you're laying, they cut them head to tail. That was the way they cut them in half. Head, split them straight down the body, laid two halves there. I just get a visual with that. You get a visual of what that looks like. You want to know why the birds were coming down, the birds of prey? Because you have these two cut in half animals and blood soaked ground. I know that's gruesome. I would ask you, if you had been the parties that were walking through, because the people would, if they're taking a covenant, they would remove their sandals and walk through the bloody path. I'm not suggesting we take that up as a tradition for marriages and weddings. But I would ask you this, if you did that and came out on the other side, how hard would it be to forget? I mean, that's the kind of image that'd be stuck in your mind for life, I think. And that was the purpose of that. Because what you were saying was, may I pay with my own blood that's now on your feet the same way these animals paid with theirs if I do not keep this covenant. And so because of that, we understand they were incredibly serious things. Covenants were not something that was done lightly. You didn't enter into a covenant to buy a cow from somebody. You just bought the cow. But if two nations were going to make a treaty and were going to agree that they weren't going to go to war, they would enact a covenant. Or sometimes there were actually marriage covenants because they were tied to country treaties. In other words, one son is marrying somebody else's daughter, leader from this country, to bring these two countries together. They would enter into that covenant type of agreement. Very serious. You remember back in the story of Ruth, again, not marriage, but Naomi lost her husband. She's got two sons, two daughters-in-law. She loses both her sons. She's going to go back. She's miserable. She actually says, I am bitter. She acknowledges that. I am bitter, which you can understand. I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying you can understand it. She lost her husband and two sons. She's going back to Jerusalem. And she's got two daughters-in-law. And they start to follow her. And she says, go back. I have nothing to offer you. I can't bear children again. I can't raise up another son for you to marry. There's nothing in my homeland for you. The two daughters-in-law, one of them, Orpah, she goes back, but Ruth does not. Ruth says, I will not go back. Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you live, I will live. Your God shall be my God. Your people shall be my people. So much of an impact is that passage that in the 80s, late 70s and 80s, there was a song called Whither Thou Goest that was sung at so many weddings. And it was based on that whole passage of Ruth. Wherever you go, I'm going. It's a serious thing, and God wants us to understand it. When I get married, it is me acknowledging that I am going to spend my life with my wife. You cannot enter it lightly, marriage. Children need to understand. You want to solve after marriage problems, because they exist, and we know that. And God grants a reason for a marriage to be dissolved, but you want to help solve that. I honestly believe if more people understood the serious nature of the covenant when they entered into it, we would have to deal with that less on the back end. Does that even make sense? It's just saying, if we understood and we were committed for life and everybody understood that, and I'm saying both parties because it takes both parties to have that commitment. I vowed to love Judy for better or for worse. You remember those kind of vows? For better or for worse, for rich or poor, for in sickness and in health, prosperity and adversity, however they said it. I like the one guy, he said yes, no, yes, no, no, yes. It's not six questions, it's one question. Under all circumstances, are you making a promise? I assumed Judy would love me in return. And she has, masterfully, has treated me. But I assumed that, but it doesn't change anything. Even had she not, I had made promises. And God expects me to be faithful to my promises as well. And then finally, marriage covenants don't come with just escape mechanisms. Like I said, God permits, don't get me wrong, God says there is a reason. There is a permission for a marriage to be severed and for somebody to be remarried again, but it wasn't the way he planned it. You want to know what God thinks about it? Go to Malachi. It says God hates divorce, the concept of it, because it is somebody or somebody's being unfaithful to promises, always. He said that's just the nature of it. He said, God says, I didn't plan marriage for you to treat like our society does, where 50% of people just decide it's not worth continuing. And so they just leave the arrangement. He says, that's not the intent behind it. I didn't provide it. You know, you go to a contract, find you a good lawyer. You're in a contract. You ever gone to one of those places that has like trampolines and rock walls and climbing? We used to do teen studies of those in Kansas City, an overnight teen deal where all the kids would come and we'd be at one of those places. And one of my good friends who worshiped up there in Kansas City with us is an attorney. And I said, look at these waivers that they want you to sign before you ever come have that event. You know, in case you fall on the trampoline and break your neck, you fall off the rock wall, whatever the case may be, they make you sign a waiver. He said, sign it. He says, trust me, it's not worth the paper it's written on. I thought, what an interesting concept. But that's all he was saying is, you understand, it's almost impossible to have a contract that somebody cannot find a way to find a loophole if it's a contract. And that's because contracts are based on mistrust. Covenants are based on trust. That is a huge difference between the two. We sign contracts with people because we think they're not going to be fair with us. Covenants are based on trust because they are a promise. They aren't, I'm doing this. You notice God didn't ask anything of Abram in Genesis chapter 15. God said, I'm making this promise to you. And so it is an arrangement wherein we enter into a promise with a partner, and that is intended to be the promise that is lifetime. God didn't say, I want you to think in terms of how you get out of this, because it's not a contract. God wants to know, are we going to work hard to keep our promises, or are we not going to work hard? There used to be a group called the Promise Keepers. I don't know how many people even remember them being around. Promise Keepers. It was just people saying, I made a promise. I'm going to remain true to my promise. Well, I would tell you, every Christian should automatically be a promise keeper. God says, let your yes be yes. Let your no be no. What I say that I'm going to do, I should do. And if I understand it's a covenant and that I have made a promise, then he says that should be binding enough for me to understand how strong the relationship of marriage is. We need to portray to the world, marriage can work if you have two people that will work at it. Thank you for your attention this morning. I would ask you, if you would, to bow with me for a word of prayer.